I'm Patricia Pierce. Welcome to the Evolutionary Activist Podcast. We are living at an important moment in our history, a time that is calling us into a new way of being, a new consciousness from which a sustainable, just, and peaceful future can arise. In this podcast, we explore ways to help that future take hold within ourselves so that together we can help it come forth in our world. Our guest today is Bob Tipton, who is an author, an entrepreneur, and innovative change architect. Bob works with organizations, mostly in the public service sector, helping them move beyond dysfunctional patterns so that they can fulfill their role for the people they serve. Bob has authored 3 books, including his most recent book, which is called What's Right, Not Who's Right, A Simple Shift to End the World's Madness. Bob is also a popular keynote speaker on the topic of transformation, and his TEDx talk is titled The Power of Fierce Agreements. So Bob, thank you very much for being with us today. I would be very curious to hear from you, since you have something like 30 plus years of experience working in the area of transformation, and particularly it seems in some organizations that a lot of people would write off as being very bureaucratic and locked in their ways. But you have found ways to help agencies and nonprofits and so forth open up to transformation. And I'm curious just what you find when you go into a setting that perhaps they're dealing with a lot of conflict or people, you know, locked in these dysfunctional patterns. How do you begin to open the door for real transformation to occur?
That's a great question. And we do run into that circumstance on a regular basis. Almost every organization we walk into has some form of, we call things like learned helplessness. They've decided that they really can't for whatever reason, or suffering in advance. In other words, they, quote unquote, will never go for it, so we'll never ask about it. What we find is also that there's a level of frustration that people have with the way that things are, and a desire at some deep level. Sometimes it's somewhat close to the surface, but a deep level for change. I think the natural human condition is not to be bureaucratic, not to be in the position of learned helplessness. I think the natural place for people to be is in a sense of curiosity, looking for joy, experiencing new things. And what we help organizations do is to realize that, A, they are in a rut. They are exhibiting conditioned responses, and they do have behaviors that are limiting their ability to look forward. Sometimes it helps for someone on the outside to come in and just point that out. And then we give them insights about what that means to them, the places where they're hindering progress, the places where employee engagement is low, and places where quality might be suffering, or timeliness, a variety of things. And then ask them. The simple question we ask is this, is do you want what you have? And the answer is almost always no. We don't want what we have. And then we followed up with this next question is, well, what would you prefer instead? And that's the place where energy starts to shift. When we spend so much of our time looking at conditioned responses and historical beliefs and biases, we spend very little time asking ourselves, what do we prefer instead? So I think that's a central piece to how we help shift the organization's energy away from the past and start looking more towards the future.
Well, what you're suggesting with those two simple questions, to me, it applies to individuals as well as organizations, because as individuals, we can get into our own ruts as well.
Oh, most definitely.
Yeah. So having really giving that some thought, do we like what we have? And if not, what would we like to see or experience? Now, when you've talked particularly recently with this new book that you have out, Who's Right, What's Right, Not Who's Right, how have you experienced that question to be central to bringing about transformation?
Human beings are are individuals. We're also part of a collective. And you know, if you go to a certain level, just in physics, everything in the universe has something to do with energy. And the energy that we bring and the energy that we radiate and the energy that we think about and all of that is critical when it comes to shaping our worldview, shaping the perspectives we have about a coworker or a relative or a neighbor or whatever it might be. And if our energy is focused on a fairly low level of competition and win-lose and I'm right and you're wrong, what happens is that that energy tends to get reflected back. The energy you put out is the energy you tend to get back. So, you know, that shows up when we're driving. If we're frustrated and we're impatient, my experience at least is I tend to get more red lights when I'm more impatient. And I think that's true for a lot of people. So anyway, it's this notion of, all right, let's put our egoic needs aside for a bit, even if that's just in the context of this conference room for this next hour for this meeting. You know, it doesn't matter what our titles are, how much money we make, where our office is in the building, where we land on the organizational structure or the hierarchy. If we're not applying that to what's right, it's really kind of irrelevant. So we ask people to do that, to put their title at the door, to leave their length of service at the door, and start looking at the big picture. Let's talk about what common interests might be, and that's another definition of what's right, and stop thinking so much about what it means to me or what's in it for me. Let's get away from the egoic need of being right. So all by itself, that dynamic, just simply asking people to focus on what's right instead of getting stuck and mired in debates about who's right, it changes everything about people's interactions.
So true. I recently just reread your book, and I really was struck by how that question of who's right has become such a polarizing issue in our culture. And I notice it in myself. There's almost like this knee-jerk reaction. And it's really, you say in your book, it's become an epidemic for us. And so we're not really able to hear purely what any particular suggestion might be, because we've already decided, depending on who's putting it forth, whether we're going to go for it or not.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I put in the category of conditioned response. So pick a name, pick a political party, pick a religious domination, pick a country, pick a neighbor or a friend or a relative. And we can be triggered immediately just simply by bringing that image to mind. And what it does is it pushes us right down the path of judgment. And we're instantly making some decision about whether that is something I'm going to pay attention to or not, whether it's meaningful or not, whether it has credence or not. And, you know, the simple but maybe not easy thing to do is to step aside from yourself for just a moment, you know, look at yourself maybe from 3 feet away and say, am I really giving that person the benefit of the doubt? I'll give you a quick example. When we're driving, I think a lot about driving, and the person in front of us doesn't move when the light turns green. They don't move within 6 nanoseconds. And what we're starting to do is to have a dialogue in our head about them, somehow saying, you know, get off your phone or quit changing the radio or do your hair later, you know, some other statement that we come up with immediately that's very judgmental about that person. Well, in reality, maybe they just got some bad news. Maybe they heard from the doctor some unwelcome health report, or a neighbor or friend has died. You know, who knows what's caused that person to wait maybe a half a second before they start moving on the green light. So what we do is we get very, very impatient, and the energy that we bring forward is impacting our decisions. So anyway, that's a simple example of where we're making a judgment about somebody where we really don't take the time to consider what life might be like for them. Mm-hmm. So you find it everywhere. Facebook, you know, social media is a great place to find this, the snarkiness, the toxic issues that I've been talking about, and kind of this, how we've become addicted to it. So you're right, Patricia, exactly.
And what I hear you saying is taking a stance of really having what I would call a generosity of spirit toward another person, and really making allowances for the depth and the complications of their own experience and whatever might be going on for them. I'm also interested by how we become so attached to our ideas and we identify ourselves. We almost equate ourselves with our ideas, which, as you've already mentioned, that's an ego sort of a thing. And I know that in the transformation work that you do, you are a person who explores the spiritual dimension of life. And you also, you understand that the consciousness that we are holding in any particular moment is pivotal. It is crucial. It defines what we are inviting forth. And I would just like to hear you speak more about that, about consciousness and the role that consciousness plays in transformation.
It's central. I mean, you hit it on the head, Patricia, when you talk about the consciousness that we're bringing is vital. It's critical to the setting that we find ourselves in. We can either choose to diffuse and interrupt or disrupt the negative consciousness and energy around us, or we can choose to accelerate and you know, promote the rumor that we heard and continue to say bad things about the people in the room or whatever it might be. We have an immediate and direct participation, almost co-creation, when it comes to the collective consciousness that we find ourselves in. So what energy are we radiating is the energy that we're going to get back. And the role of consciousness, a little bit like this, you know, the law of attraction and the secret, and you know, the books about how you manifest things and bring things into your life, and all the power of positive thinking and so on. All of that is maybe a place to start. But unless it's in harmony, unless it's in coherence with the non-local consciousness, in other words, my personal mantra here is what wants to happen here. There's a flow, there's an energy, there's a consciousness that permeates every setting, every interaction, every situation that we find ourselves in. And if we stop and ask ourselves what wants to happen here, as opposed to what do we think we need to make happen here, we're all of a sudden operating in coherence with what the non-local consciousness is looking for. The trick is, in organizational life and transformation in particular, the trick is to get enough people to align with that at the same time for the same reason that it starts to look like the organization is transforming. In reality, it's one person at a time. The consciousness that we each bring needs to transform one person at a time. So there's a very practical component to this. I think people often think that this, you know, consciousness and so on is too ethereal, it's too amorphous, it's too woo-woo, it's too way out there. I look at it as a very practical thing. The more aligned the organization is around a positive, collective view of what wants to happen, the better the results. Trust is high, time frames shorten, costs go down, employee engagement goes up, results are improved. So why wouldn't we try focusing on something that is deep and meaningful and ancient and real, frankly? Why wouldn't we focus on that? Call it consciousness, if you will. I call it just the practical energy of having people move in a positive direction.
Mm-hmm. And out of the realm of egoic control, of wanting to manipulate the situation into this openness and becoming a channel for what wants to come forth.
Exactly.
Yeah. So how do you help? You say, like you say, it's one person at a time choosing to adopt that sort of a stance, to let go of their own desire to control the situation, let go of their own desire to focus on what do I want to see happen here, and really open up to this question of what wants to happen in this moment. First of all, how do you do that in your own life? And then how do you facilitate other people doing that in organizations that you work with?
Great, great questions. And answering your first one first, how do I deal with that or manage that or live that in my own life? I'm going to have to say that, you know, my ego is pretty sticky. It probably took me to be in my mid-30s or so before I realized that asking for help was a sign of strength as opposed to a sign of weakness or vulnerability being bad, and somehow putting on the air of capability and ability in any circumstance. So understanding that vulnerability is actually where the power comes from takes some time for people. Personally, for me, it took some, relatively significant suffering, honestly, to discover that I'm really not that important in the big picture of things, the things that I want. And the way that I look at my ego is central to how that fits. So the realization for me is that the ego is nothing to kill off. I think that's something that people often look at as, well, that's the goal. We'll just kill the ego. Well, we can't do that. We need it to be able to plan our trip to work, and we need it to be able to pay our bills. And there's just some very practical pieces to what the ego needs to do. However, ego is always object. It's never subject. In other words, it's not really who I am. It's the role that I'm playing in the circumstance that I find myself in. And when I can disconnect myself from that, guess what? Everything changes. My perspective changes. I allow what wants to happen. I enable what wants to happen. I co-create what wants to happen, as opposed to sitting back and saying, gosh, I'm the smartest person in the room, and these are the things that I need to make happen. So there's a level of suffering and honestly just some maturity and some time that's necessary in order for that to happen. Translating that into organizational life, it's about finding the place to put the lever and the fulcrum in an organization and find the blockages and find the individuals who have the biggest impact, the connectors, if you will, that if we get them moving, the rest of the organization starts to unblock. It starts to move itself. So that's part of the assessment work when we go into a client engagement, is to determine where that point of inflection is, where that point of leverage needs to be, and then we focus there. So I have a meeting later this afternoon, today even, bringing two people together that are in protracted, deep conflict together. And the energy that these two individuals in this larger organization of about 200 people, the energy these two people are presenting is what's causing the other 198 people not to be able to move. So we've been working for months to get this meeting done. I am very optimistic that it'll have great results.
Yeah, what you're saying about how that energy can ripple out, it doesn't take many people to be in that kind of a conflictual energy for it to really affect the whole system, which just speaks to the fact that we are all interconnected. So when we're holding that energy, we are affecting everybody around us. Mm-hmm. When you talk about the ego, I was just remembering, I was in a coffee shop yesterday and I walked by a table where a young, I think he was a Penn student, according to his t-shirt, had a book called, it said, Ego is the Enemy. I thought, well, I don't think I would put it that way. But anyway, it was sort of funny. When you talk about vulnerability, I understand that in a lot of workplaces, vulnerability is really risky. People in a lot of workplaces and organizations have a hard time being vulnerable in front of their colleagues. And yet you're also talking about the role of vulnerability as a kind of a power. So how do you navigate that, and how do you bring the power of vulnerability into the work that you do?
So one of the first things to do is to talk about what vulnerability is not when you're describing it for people. Often people think vulnerability is weakness. It's exactly the opposite of that. It is courage. It requires a high level of personal risk and courage to truly be vulnerable. The other thing about vulnerability is that somehow it means that you're missing something, that you're lacking something by being vulnerable. In reality, it's the opposite as well. What you're speaking to is what is present, what is available, as opposed to what's not there. So asking people, especially from a leadership perspective, these connectors that we talked about just a couple of minutes ago, to demonstrate vulnerability means this: they are accountable for their own actions and their own behaviors. They operate in a trustworthy manner. In other words, they have integrity with their words and actions. They follow through on their commitments, and they admit it when they have fallen short. They are transparent and forthcoming, which is different than being honest. I always have a red flag go up when someone says, "Can I be honest with you?" It's like, well, are we just starting that now, or is that something that?
Yeah, what have we been doing up until now?
Yeah. Should I replay the rest of our conversation and put it through the filter of you weren't? I think what we really mean at that point when we say that is I want to be forthcoming. I want to be transparent.
I want to say the hard thing that I haven't yet said.
Yeah, exactly. And asking for their permission to demonstrate that sometimes is meaningful or necessary in a relationship where trust has not grown or trust has been damaged for whatever reason. So to me, vulnerability requires the courage of personal accountability. It requires the courage of transparency and forthcomingness, and it requires the courage of trustworthy behaviors. That to me is completely the opposite of weakness. So it helps as a consultant doing the work that my team and I do, it helps for us to demonstrate that in the way that we conduct ourselves with our clients. So if we've missed something on an agenda or we've misled someone unintentionally through a phrase or a word or some choice that we made, we own it. We also talk about the transparent and forthcoming information that's necessary for us to do the work that we do. So it's inviting people, it's modeling the behavior, and it really, back to what I said at the beginning, it's defining what vulnerability actually is.
Yeah, I think that there is a great deal of misunderstanding about what that is, because I think we are socialized to not display any sort of, to use the word that you used, what we would consider to be weakness. In other words, to be vulnerable, like you're saying, indicates in this narrative, it indicates that we are somehow deficient. There's something wrong with us.
Yep.
That if we had it all together, there, we would not have any vulnerability in us. And I know that you've referred a lot to the work of Brené Brown, who, of course, delves into this quite a bit.
Oh, yeah. Her, I think she still has the number one TED Talk in terms of views of all of them. It's her talk on vulnerability. And one of the things that really speaks to me in her message in particular is, you know, she asked the question, what's the opposite of scarcity? And most people would look at the opposite of scarcity as being abundance. You know, that's kind of how we're conditioned. And our, you know, pop culture tells us more is better. Her answer to that question, what's the opposite of scarcity, is this. It's enough. Mm-hmm. And when we're able to look at ourselves in the mirror or through prayer or meditation or, you know, however we get in touch with ourselves, when we answer the question, am I enough, authentically, we say yes, authentically, I'm enough, man, everything in life changes.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. I know Lynn Twist has said, I think actually she heard Buckminster Fuller say something similar many, many years ago, that it's not about abundance, it's about sufficiency, which is the same as enough.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Same concept.
Yeah. So may I ask you to be a little bit vulnerable and share with us?
Of course.
Share with us something of your spiritual journey and how that, or your spiritual orientation and how that informs the work that you do and vice versa.
Okay. Absolutely. Let me say that I have had a difficult relationship with all forms of organized religion throughout my life. It doesn't mean I haven't tried them, but I've had a difficult relationship with them. I always felt that there was some level of practicing and doing as opposed to being and connecting. So I've got a bit of a problem with, if you do these six things, then this result happens. I question things too much from that viewpoint. I also will say that even as a very young child, I had a sense that the universe's energy moved in in certain frequencies and certain dimensions that were really beyond our human understanding. I think it was Aldous Huxley that called the brain the great reducing valve, in that we can't experience the strangeness of the universe. We're just not able to. And the enormity of God and spirit, we just cannot experience all of it. We don't have the mechanism available to us to make that happen. So whenever I see some ways that human beings try to limit or reduce the spirit, the God, non-local consciousness, whatever term you want to use, so that we can understand it, that's a statement about people. That's not a statement about spirit. So using that as a bit of a backdrop, really for the last 15 years or so, I've been on an intentional and deep journey to, ultimately, it comes down to understanding the perennial tradition or the wisdom tradition, perennial philosophy that so many talk about, and a little bit like a nice wine sauce on the stove that you reduce down. If you take all the core essences of all the spiritual faiths on the world and the healthy forms of religion, and you boil it all down to its essence, it all points in the same direction, the same source, the same connection for all of us. So my spiritual journey is to unlearn, to strip away, to get rid of the barriers that exist between me and that experience of the non-local consciousness in its purest form. So I am constantly looking at how my biases, my beliefs, my conditioned responses, my philosophies, whatever they might be, are limiting, and spending as much time as I'm able to, as frequently as I'm able to, and as deeply as I'm able to in direct experience. Mm-hmm. So I'm a deeply spiritual person. I'm just not very good at religion.
What you're talking about with unlearning, I think of that in terms of a word that I use is undoctrination.
Uh-huh. I saw it in your book. I love that word.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's a real word, if it's a Pierce-ism, but I really like that word.
It may be both. I don't know. And I just want to share with our listeners that the way that we connected, there's a story behind all of this, that we went to school together from elementary school all the way through high school. And we knew each other sort of in passing, and we played, we were in band and such together, brass quintet. And then at our 40th high school reunion, we saw each other, and we discovered that we have this connection around spirituality. And so I've really just delighted in getting to know you in this way, and to observe the work that you're doing with organizations and the depth of your own inner exploration, and how that enriches the work that you do and informs the work that you do. And also, I just want to mention that for the listeners, has it been about 15 years that you've been leading this group that you call Quantum Faith?
Yes.
Yeah, and that's a group in Denver that reads all kinds of books on spirituality. So I consider you to be a very erudite person when it comes to spiritual traditions and what's out there, and very, very well-rounded.
Well, I appreciate that, and I'll echo the same thing. I mean, it was so fun reconnecting with you, but in the same way, I'm getting to know you for the first time. We spent a lot of years in the same circle, but we really didn't know each other well. And it is back to this perennial tradition. You know, your journey and my journey are quite different, but they're pointing now in the same direction. And that's been fun to explore also, is how each of us, you and I and others that would be listening to this, wind up in a similar place, even though we don't start in the same place. And one more time, back to the healthy expression of religion, back to the core essence of all the spiritual teachings and shaman and gurus and, you know, whoever else you want to put on the list, it all points in the same place. And looking at it from an organizational viewpoint, it extends, it translates into groups, it translates into entire organizations. And even, you know, the title of our group, Quantum Faith, we not only study spirituality, but we also study science very deeply, and really the ways that the universe expresses itself. So scientifically, spiritually, culturally, psychologically, we just want to learn how the universe expresses itself. And in the quantum world, you know, there's some very, very strange dynamics. If you studied any of it, as soon as you start learning about it, you realize you'll never understand it. It's impossible to know.
Right.
The bottom just keeps dropping out of it. But
yeah.
This concept of entrainment and entanglement, you know, they talk about that at the particle level, but I see that at the consciousness level.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're entraining or entangling people around a positive consciousness and high energy, it feeds itself almost like a conflagration in a fire. It feeds itself and it starts growing. So anyway, I'm not sure I understand how all this works, and I guess I don't need to. It's a matter of allowing what wants to happen and realizing that when we're in flow and connected to the energy as it's moving, amazing things happen.
Yeah. And I suspect that that's one reason that you're so effective working with groups, is because you yourself are aligning with a particular kind of energy, and that allows the group to entrain to that energy.
Yes, I'm intentional about that. So, you know, I'm a terrible meditator. I don't know if you are, Patricia. I guess we've never talked about that, but I'm terrible at it, because, or at least in the way you think it should be done. And that's back to that conditioned response where you quiet your mind for 20 minutes or an hour and just wait for insight to come forward. And I'm lousy at that. My brain works too quickly, and I've got this monkey mind that just never shuts down. But what I've been able to do successfully is to make it my own. And I probably meditate, I don't know, 500 times a day, 300 times a day. I don't.
Mm-hmm. Micro meditations.
Yeah, it's Japa meditation, I think, is what Wayne Dyer would call it, if I'm remembering his perspective. And it's the space between words. It's the pause between thoughts. It's the at the red light kind of centering yourself before you go into a meeting. So I do that all the time. And I found that to be very, very effective for me. So I spend the time intentionally centering myself before I go into a potentially challenging meeting, where the energy I bring as the facilitator, as the guide, is critical to helping the outcome move forward.
Yeah. Yeah, I find that as well, that it only takes a moment, really. It just takes a moment to tune in to that timeless dimension.
That's it.
In terms of meditation, and back to entrainment, I also find that it's, in meditation, I go so much deeper when I'm doing it with others who are meditating.
Yeah.
Because there is this collective quieting of the mind that is so powerful.
Yeah, there's one aspect where I find that worked for me. Hemi-syncing, have you ever done any hemi-syncing with sound?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, it's getting to the very low-level brain waves and entraining them within a group with yourself, but actually causing your brain to start, I think it's the theta waves. I can never remember the actual term, but I think that the very, very slow brain waves. And it's a process of hearing sound in each ear in a repetitive, rhythmic kind of way, almost like the effect of drumming.
Uh-huh.
But it's a guided form of sound-based meditation. We did that a couple of nights at Quantum Faith. We had somebody's iPhone or iPod or something, and we had about 15 people all wired up listening to the same thing at the same time through the headphones. You can imagine a spider web of wires connecting
mm-hmm.
in
yeah.
the middle of the room. And it was fascinating to have everyone reach a similar destination together almost instantaneously. So I would agree with that. Your perspective of doing things together is helpful.
Yeah. I've experienced sound meditation. I don't know if it's exactly what you're referring to. And of course, shamanic drumming, which also alters the brain waves. So anyway, all of those things are really so fascinating to me, how we can step outside of that ordinary state of consciousness and enter into this other state where we can experience ourselves as being one with a much greater reality.
Exactly.
Well, are there any other closing words of wisdom that you would like to share with us about your work in transformation and how we ourselves can perhaps be the change in these times that brings the change and really truly be agents of transformation in our own individual lives?
Yeah, I'm not so sure about words of wisdom, but maybe some hard-fought lessons. Working with people and groups and so on for as many years as I have. And this also fits for parenting, for anyone that's wrestling, especially with teenagers. So this is useful. I think one thing to remember, and it fits into the category of compassionate detachment. I know in your work as a former pastor and counselor and all that, it's critical to maintain a level of objectivity and separation, yet have that be all based in compassion. And remind ourselves about two things when we find ourselves in maybe a challenging situation that's full of who's right behavior instead of what's right energy. And that is, we're not responsible for somebody else's happiness. We can't make them feel anything. And it's hard to watch people be unhappy. All we can do is invite them, ask them if they want what they have, and then invite them to think about what they prefer instead. And the other aspect of it is that we can't do another person's suffering for them. And that's where compassion becomes unhealthy. That's where the detachment starts to get in the way, and it starts to look like enabling behavior or something, is when we try to do someone else's suffering for them. I have a story in my book that I'd like to maybe close with, and it's a woman, she's the wife of someone I know well. I used to work with him deeply, and she suffers from extreme depression, and he has stopped her twice mid-suicide attempts. This is not a simple thing for her. It's a very, very dark and hard thing for her to manage. And he asked her at one point, he said, you know, of all the people that have weighed in and offered assistance to you, who is the person that you found to be most comforting of everyone that you've talked to? And she said, I have a friend who just sits with me and rubs my feet. No words are exchanged, no hollow promises, no saying whatever I can do, no attempts at empathy, just the simple act of being present and rubbing her feet is the one that makes her feel the most cared for. So we can't do other people's work for them. Sometimes the right thing to do is just to be with them and rub their feet.
Mm, that's so beautiful. Just the gift of presence.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I encourage listeners to check out your website, which is teamtipton.com. And there people can learn more about the work that you do and also find out about the books that you have. And your latest, again, is What's Right, Not Who's Right, A Simple Shift to End the World's Madness. And I just think this is a gem of a book. So thank you for putting it out into the world. And thank you for taking time to be with us today, Bob.
Most definitely. Always good to be with you, Patricia. Thank you.
Okay, take care. And to everyone, until next week, peace.